The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 2nd, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's good to see you. Well, this evening, I thought I would like to talk about awe. A-W-E. Maybe awe. An awakening. When I think of something like awe, as I was getting ready this evening, I had a memory that just came back to me of it was a time some years ago I used to travel to Menominee for Warren Lang's group over in Menominee, about 75 miles or so east of the Twin Cities. And it was on one of those evenings when I was there, probably getting close to 10 o'clock or so, and in the evening. So driving home in the dark. And I remember this one particular time when, as I was driving I-94, you know, back to the cities, still way out in the country though, a countryside there in Wisconsin, and I could see coming through my windshield the Aurora Borealis, you know, the Northern Lights, and I was really amazed. I grew up with this. I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, where we often could see the Northern Lights, and sometimes it'd be far more spectacular than others. I remember prior to this time, probably the most spectacular view I had of the Northern Lights was it was in the wintertime up north of Ely, Minnesota, which is up getting up near the Canadian border, pretty far north, and I was up there with some friends, and we had rented some cabins and things up on the Echo Trail there, and we were doing some cross-country skiing, and but this one particular night, just stepping outside, and the sky, you know, far away from the city lights, very bright, the stars very bright, and you see some spectacular celestial sights when you're out away from the city. Anyway, that was a spectacular, that night it was a spectacular display of the Aurora Borealis, but here, driving back from Menominee, which isn't that far north, well, it's north enough, I guess, I mean, we can see it there, but I was surprised at how bright and full this display was. The fact that I could still see even on the freeway where there was lights. And so I pulled off on a side road off the freeway there and took a country road getting away from all the lights that I could. And it was, you know, farmland, it was dark. And stopped my car and got out and looked at this spectacular display in the sky of the Northern Lights, and I stood there for quite a while. It was cold. It was, again, it was, I don't think it was dead winter or anything, but it was pretty chilly, I remember. But it was just wonderful. Somehow even the coldness of it kind of adds to the display, I think, in some way. The coldness is huge, is vast, and of course something like the Northern Lights. If any of you have, I'm sure many of you have seen this. If you're too far south, I feel sorry for you. You don't get the opportunity as much, but it is really something quite spectacular. Well, anyway, that's what came to mind when I was. I'd already been working on it or looking at what I was going to be talking about for some time, but it was just this evening now that I just remembered that as I thought it could be an example of something rather spectacular and awe-inspiring when you see a display like that in the sky. Well, anyway, what I was going to talk about, what I already had in mind to talk about, was just some thoughts that were kind of prodded by an article that appeared last summer, actually, last June, in Discover magazine, and it was titled Awestruck. And I want to give you a very quick review of what that article had to say, and then I think I might want to go through it again and look at it kind of from a Dharma perspective, some of the things that were mentioned in this article. But according to this article, so a very brief outline of what that contained, that article, it said that that according to psychologists, there's two things that are needed for us to experience awe, A-W-E, awe. And the first one is that you have to perceive something vast. This is required. And it could either be vast in physical size, looking at a vast display of changing, flowing, moving lights in the sky, covering the sky. That certainly gives you a sense of vastness. Like I said, to the cold itself seemed to lend itself to this, something vast, big, huge. Up here in Minnesota, out in the countryside and getting further north, the cold can kill you. And that's something huge, all-enveloping. Of course, there's ways to protect yourself against that sort of thing, but it is something rather awesome and awe-inspiring. So, according to psychologists, according to this article, the first thing it is you have to experience something vast. Perceive, it says, perceive something vast. And either in physical size, it says, or in scope. And then they give examples of, like, if you attend a lecture, not that this one's going to inspire any kind of awe or anything, but maybe a very stirring lecture of some kind. But that was an example that they gave. Or you go to a museum and you see some, artifacts from Egypt or ancient Egypt or whatever, any number of things, or art or music. Or perhaps an idea is another example that they gave. They used the term mind-blowing. You encounter a mind-blowing idea of some kind, and this could inspire awe. And that first kind of this physical size, this kind of vastness, that they refer to that as perceptual awe. And this other kind of awe they call a conceptual awe, the kind where it's vastness in scope, or in the lecture or the museum experience or the an idea that you might encounter. So that's how they kind of set that up. But then in the article, the author went on to point out different things associated with awe. And the first thing listed there, first two things actually were contrasted. One is, the first one was thoughts about oneself. Okay, this is associated with awe. And the second one, which the author contrasted with the first, is sort of contradictory to the first. Maybe not. We'll be taking a look at this. But the second one is compassion for others. So these are things associated with awe. First, thoughts about oneself. Second is compassion for others. Third is association with awe is being more humble and happy and having a sense of well-being is associated with awe. A fourth thing listed there was generosity, feeling more generous. Fifth thing associated with awe is being more ethical. And sixth, things like personal goals, this becomes less important to you, less concerned with this. And then finally, seventh was having more, just in general, having more concern for others. So these were the things that the author had listed as being associated with awe. And so I thought I'd like to just go back and touch on these points again, but maybe from a Dharma perspective. So according to psychologists, yeah, two things needed. First, just to experience something vast, something outside yourself, perhaps. And this would be in just vastness in physical size, it said. But and it says to perceive something vast, and vast in physical size. And then they refer to this as perceptual awe. But I would say that this kind of awe, if you're perceiving something, well, first of all, you can't perceive something vast. You can't perceive something, you know, vast in physical size. There's only, and you, perhaps you can't really perceive awe at all. I don't know if we can say that there is perceptual awe as such. From the point of view, if there is a point of view of the awakened, awe would be something actually conceptual. And when we see something vast or experience something vast, this is a part of our conceptual experience. Now, I don't want to be killing any sense that people might have of experiencing awe and that sort of thing. I've certainly experienced it many times in my life, from as far back as I can remember up until the present day, from time to time, we experience awesome things. So I'm not putting that down, or I'm not trying to diminish it in any way, the experience of awe. I think it was wonderful, great. I love these moments when we experience something like that. But I'm just saying, in contrasting this with something like enlightenment or awakening, it's not the same thing. And part of why I wanted to talk about this is because I think sometimes we have the impression that many of us, if we get acquainted with the idea, the concept of enlightenment, if that's what we get acquainted with, we might really want to experience something like that. And we might end up thinking in our minds that we're talking about experiencing something awesome, something grand and wonderful. And while it is wonderful to experience things such as these, enlightenment isn't like this. It is something really quite different, because it is perceptual. It is the perceptual experience itself, getting in touch with that and awakening to that. But it doesn't strike us as being something vast. Now, I should say this too about when they talk about perceptual awe, the psychologists, and they're talking about that we have to experience something, physically vast in size and this sort of thing. And I think that the examples that they had in the article were kind of pointing to things rather large, mountains and things of this sort, mountains and rivers, But this vastness, of course, actually goes in both directions. We just consider the vastness of the numbers of, within our own body, the organisms. There are more organisms living in your mouth and your throat and nose, right now, than of all the human beings that have ever lived on Earth. Just in the bacteria and things that we have, just within our mouth and nasal passages, right now. Each of us. So there's vastness right there. But of course this is conceptual, because we certainly didn't know this for much of human existence, but now with our modern science and everything, we discovered this. But there we encounter vastness right there, or the intricacies of the body, not just the human body, but the bodies of all different plants and animals virtually everything is living. There's vastness right there. We can see vastness in the infinitesimal, in the very tiny, the very small. So it is all around us. And I think to the extent that we can get outside of ourselves and forget ourselves, we can taste this, we can experience, we can sense this. So it isn't just necessarily looking at something like the Aurora Borealis and feeling this sense of awe. We can begin to feel it in all sorts of ways. This physical awe or this perceptual awe that they talk about. Also in this other kind that we have to experience, you have to perceive this in order to have this sense of awe, they say. And the other one is in scope, and this one they call the conceptual awe. And here's the examples that they gave of the lecture of the museum or the mind-blowing idea or something that we might encounter. And this also, they would say, but they call this conceptual awe. But what I would say is that in order to experience awe itself, to experience awe at all, it is all conceptual. Because the perceptual simply doesn't give us this. It doesn't give us any sense of size or vastness or a diminished size, you know, very small, tiny, you know, minuscule. That is not what the perceptual. The perceptual is of wholeness and totality. It is sizeless. It is objectless. In order to experience things like size and dimension of, you know, vastness or smallness or whatever it might be, that is the conceptual, which is contrasting one thing from another. That is all part of the world of this and that. This is our ordinary consciousness, and it is with our ordinary consciousness that we can experience something vast and awe-inspiring and all of that. There's also the awful. I don't want to, the article got into the awful as well. I don't know if I'm going to say too much about that, but that 12 to 24%, they say, of all awe-inspiring experiences are awful, where the awe runs in the direction where it's it seems to be rather could be frightening or something of that sort. And they said, and this is often associated with things like with feelings of shame and fear and disgust, you know, the awful, they said. But I don't know if I want to get into that, but this could work in either direction. I just wanted to at least say that, but I might not pull out any examples of that. But so in order then to have what the psychologists are calling awe, to experience this, which again I think is a wonderful thing. I'm not putting this down because I enjoy this. I love this. In fact, I think it's actually quite necessary for awakening. But it isn't awakening itself. Well, I'll give you a hint right now. I was going to work my way up to this, but I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do this. So I'll just give it to you right now. To use the example of mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. That's number one. When I first encountered Zen, first mountains were mountains and rivers are rivers. And then we experience that mountains are not mountains, rivers are not. This is kind of the awe stage. We can feel that the all is one and there's this vastness, and we experience this. And we experience it. One of the things associated with this is, in the article it says thoughts about oneself. Yeah, well, this, could come into play there. That against this is so contrary to the way that we normally experience things, and we're beginning maybe to get some sense of something that's more vast or outside of myself or something like this. But this is still not enlightenment. It is finding when we get to number three there. So mountains are first, mountains are mountains, and rivers are rivers. Mountains are not mountains, rivers are not rivers. Finally, we have mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And this is with awakening, which is quite different than where we were with number one. But so I just want to interject that right now. That might help to give you, because I'm assuming most of you are, probably all of you are familiar with that, that image of mountains and mountains are mountains. And that might help you to get a sense of where I'm going with this here. But I want to look at this where they lay out that the awe is associated with these various things. And the first one listed was that thoughts, awe is associated with first encountering this thing that's vast in scope or size or whatever. And then it's associated with thoughts about oneself. they say. That's the first thing listed. And and so it is with that contrast. Like, I feel so tiny compared to the vastness of the universe, or even just the night sky, particularly the night sky when we're out away from the city and we can really see the depth of the sky with the stars, and with our telescopes we can look at the galaxies, and or even if you're just out in nature in general, very often we can feel rather small. And whether we go to the canyon lands of the west or to other places. So they said we have thoughts about oneself here, but it's kind of thoughts where we're relating myself to that vast thing out there that we've experienced. But again, this would be a conceptual experience, purely conceptual, where we have the structured thing here, me, I. We might have some sense of myself as a distinct and separate thing, but we probably do, unless we fully wake up. And it will be in contrast to so much else that's out there that we feel minuscule. And even when we look inwardly, as I was giving some examples earlier, just the things that are within the body, not just the organs and the cells and all of this of our body and that sort of thing, but even all the microbes and things that are so much a part of us that they're a part of our digestion and so many other things. We couldn't survive and live without all the trillions of cells that are in our body that don't even carry our DNA. You know, and again, this is vastness and of a sort. So, but this is one thing that's associated then with this sense of awe. And again, I find it wonderful and exhilarating to be aware of these things, to wake up to these, to have learned about these things from others who have studied such things. And they can let us know what is there within the experience. But again, this is entirely within the conceptual. The perceptual is there too. We're never without it. It's always with us. But that is not of this sort of the multiplicity and the vastness and all of that. It is sizeless. It is ever present. It is always now. But it isn't divided and multiple. So another thing associated then with this sense of awe is compassion for others. Yeah, because to the extent that we have a sense of the vastness of everything that is around us and within us, and we see ourselves among many other creatures and not just other people, but things of all sorts. And we can begin to realize that our life is fully intertwined and intermixed with, interdependent, with so many other beings and things as well. It's a way of just kind of getting outside of ourselves. But this is still the conceptual, because with the perceptual there's no sense of other, no sense of separation that is there. So not to be confused with awakening, this sense of awe. But again, I think I've already mentioned, but one of the things I do want to bring out tonight is that this sense of awe is, I don't want to say required, but it will be there with awakening itself. It's necessary, let's put it that way, that we have this sense of awe. And with this, getting a more diminished sense of ourself as something that otherwise could easily remain the focal point of everything that concerns us. So the third point then that's associated, as they have in the article there, is that with this sense of awe, this sense of vastness in scope or physical size or whatever, that we become more humble. We also become happier, it says. And also we have a sense of well-being. And again, this is right there with it. It is not awakening that gives us this. That's all the perceptual. It really doesn't give you anything at all. But it does light all of this up. and it is right there with this. But to the extent that we can take our attention outside of ourselves into this vastness, whether it's truly vast in a physical size or physical way or in many other ways as well, this can allow us to become more humble, less focused on ourselves. And with this is a greater degree of happiness. This is just simply how it is. To the extent that we can turn our attention in this way, I think it can be directly seen that to the extent that we forget ourselves, we are happier. And life becomes easier, even under very trying times that we are now all experiencing, given the COVID pandemic and so many other things that are happening in the world today. But we can be happier, more humble, and also we can. This helps to bring forth a sense of well-being that wouldn't be there to the extent that we're preoccupied with ourselves, my little self here, and all the things that threaten me, and all the things that I want, and I can't have, I can't get those things, and there's other things that come at me, and I don't want them. All of this, that's not a sense of well-being, but it is something that's occupying the mind unnecessarily because it doesn't have to be that way. To the extent that we can realize this vastness within the experience that's continuing in spite of ourselves, we can, within that, we can begin to lose our sense of self altogether. The fourth thing associated with this sense of, they say, is generosity. Yeah, and generosity, to the extent that we see ourselves as, first we might see ourselves as a part of a community of other people or other beings or other creatures. We can be generous to plants and animals as well, to care for them and all of this sort of thing, but certainly to other humans, human beings, and we can be very giving and all of this. But again, this is all part of the conceptual. Everything, most of what I've been describing here, belongs to the conceptual, which is right there with ordinary consciousness. But as we lose ourselves within all of this, then where goes the generosity? Well, we have this in our teaching that with awakening, with seeing, with wisdom, we begin to see that true generosity takes place when there is no giver and no receiver, and there is nothing that is given or taken. This is to see this with the eye of wisdom and understanding what is really taking place here. And this is true giving, where the thing that otherwise might seem to remain separate and apart from me here, and I want to give, I have a generous heart right now, and I want to help. I see a suffering person, a hungry person, I want to give them some food or something like this. And of course there's giving, but there's also giving that takes place where there isn't any sense of that other, that other person is something other, because this is what you are. This is what we experience. This is what our life is. It is what we see. It is what we hear. It is what we feel and taste and touch. It is what we think and believe. Though belief will fracture things and divide things and separate things, that's not a particularly healthy aspect of this. And it keeps things divided. It keeps strengthening the sense of otherness. But that can be lost in the midst of all of this, and so this can. And this doesn't appear just in Buddhism either. We find it in Christianity, where Jesus, spoke of loving your enemy, loving your neighbor as yourself. But the only way you can really truly do this is when you see your neighbor or your enemy. You don't see them as enemy. You don't see them as something separate from you. They are your life. And we can take care of them in that very same way, with that very same heart that we might have toward ourselves, or at least toward our loved ones or our family of our kind, that sort of thing. But this can be carried all the way out till there's no distinctions or separations drawn in our mind or in our heart at all. So this is generosity. But it, in experiencing this awesomeness which I was sort of likening to this second stage of mountains are mountains and mountains are not mountains. Yeah, so generosity will begin to appear in a radically different way from our normal thought of generosity. At the more benighted way of looking at generosity, we might be giving because, well, it makes me feel better, or I'm giving because it looks good, you know. So it might, if I can come off as sort of a giving person, you know, people might think better of me or something like this. But that isn't even really giving at all. Well, there's this superficial giving that's going on, but it's not actually taking place. So there's a whole spectrum there, from that on the one end to the other, where we don't even see a giver or a receiver. We're not keeping tabs, we're not keeping a record, an account of anything, any kind of transactions that are taking place. Okay, but that sense of generosity is there with the awesomeness. Another thing associated with that is that they listed there is, well, we'll become, to the extent that we experience this thing that is vast, and we perceive, well, they say perceive, but conceiving this, we're tasting this, we're experiencing this, we're allowing this in, so we take note of it, then to that extent we will become more ethical. And more to the extent that we're not seeing the other as something separate and apart from me. Of course, the natural thing will be to become more fair, more generous, and more ethical. Our way of treating others, while we would certainly, we might begin with something like the golden rule, make a little rule about it, that I'll do unto others as I would have them do unto me. But we can go farther and farther with this until we might begin to realize the negative version of the golden rule, which is the most highly moral way we could possibly act. And it is a golden rule, even though it's in a negative form. But that is just simply to not do unto others what you would not have done unto you. This is actually flawless, and it is the prime form of the golden rule, the pure form of the golden rule. The golden rule by itself, it's pretty far along on that spectrum, you know, of how we might be toward others. Yeah, but to do to others as you would have done unto you, well, they might not want or need what you need or want. So that isn't particularly helpful. But what we can do is to learn to keep our hands off and to not interfere, and to, so we don't do unto others what we would not have done unto ourselves. And that's probably the ultimate expression of, you know, living out of that, where you don't see, and with this, we're really not seeing the other as something separate or apart in any way whatsoever. It is also seeing things in terms of, I think most of you know the story of Yaka-san, you know, sitting, his teacher asks him, what are you doing? And he says, I'm not doing anything. So he's sitting in this way. This is his meditation. I'm not doing anything. You're sitting idly then. No, if I were sitting idly, I'd be doing something. So it is, you know, acting in this. And this is the ultimate expression of ethical behavior. Another thing then associated with this sense of awe that they expressed in that article is that our personal goals will become less important to us. And that certainly would be the case to the extent that we get outside of ourselves and lose ourselves, drop ourselves. We don't stop seeing ourselves as isolated and removed from other in any way at all, where we realize that we are this vastness, this universe, this wholeness, this totality. It is not something separate and apart from us in any way whatsoever, to the extent that we actually see this and realize this, then something such as personal goals, you have very little sense of that at all, and these become very much less important for us. Again, if we're also happier at that point, it might seem a little strange or counterintuitive or whatever. But that really is the case, to the extent that we're occupied with ourselves and our own goals and our own strivings and what it is that we want for ourselves or even our friends and family and that sort of thing. But we're not particularly happy at that point. I think we can look around. We have some very good examples of lifestyles where people work very hard at pleasing themselves and getting what they want and getting what they want for their friends and this sort of thing. And you can, if you look carefully, you can see a great deal of misery there, supreme misery, misery that I find almost unbearable to contemplate. And I feel very sorry for such people. But if we look at this carefully and trust it, this is faith in Buddhism, by the way. We put our faith, our trust in what we can actually experience. To the extent that we can forget ourselves and our own personal things, we become, to the extent that they become less important to us, we become happier and more settled. And have a stronger sense of well-being, all of that. Finally, the last thing then that was listed as being associated with this sense of awe is having, we would have more concern for others. Yeah. And that also, fits right in with this. But to the extent that that remains conceptual, again, there'll be that division, that separation of me from the others. Even though we might have more concern, the concern will still be tied to some degree, a greater or lesser degree, with a concern for self. To the extent that we can forget the self, then the other becomes not something that's other at all, but this is truly what your life is. Your life is just this that's being lived out right now. And with that, again, there is this sense of well-being, happiness, whatever. Okay. So this article on awe, how we experience awe, it was very interesting, very good. I liked it. I loved what it pointed out. It gave some very good examples. But I just thought that, it's interesting. We can look at this dharmically. And we can move beyond just being awestruck or having this incredible experience for ourselves. But the thing I wanted to, again, bring out was to help us to realize, because I certainly had thoughts like this, I think, long ago at the beginning when I was first following this way. And I think many people do, that somehow, if I could just get enlightenment or something, it would just be this great, awesome experience or something like this. And so we'll keep approaching. Maybe our whole life we're taking up this practice because we're expecting some. It's bigger than just a huge fireworks display. It's going to be just awesome. It's just we're looking at it as something like that. To the extent that full blown awakening strikes, you'll barely feel a thing. But it will be the dropping away of an awful lot of pain and confusion. But there is nothing particularly, fiery or doesn't necessarily strike. Well, to the extent that there is some sense of awe as such, we're still locked in the conceptual. Or at least we're dragging some fumes or something from the conceptual, and that's still part of the picture. And there could be awakening there. I'm not saying that. There might be some real understanding, but there's still a residue of ego, of self, of accomplishment, or getting something, or a relief, and that sort of thing. That's still not anuttara samyaksambodhi. Yeah, that is still some ordinary mind there. So don't look or expect awakening to be something awesome. If you continue to look for that, you won't even know when the awakened moment passes by, and it don't think it doesn't. You've all tasted this. You taste it all the time, actually. But most of the time, we just don't recognize it because, well, either if we are looking for, most of the time we're not even doing that. But if we are, we're probably looking for something special, something great, something awe-inspiring. Just don't look at it. Don't expect it in that way. In fact, just kind of forget about it. But just live your life, but directly, without a lot of calculation or anything of that sort. You really don't need that. just burn it up in each moment as it's being lived, you know, completely. And eventually, the awakening is in that, and you'll know it. Okay. Well, it's only 8:30, but I think I said about as much as I was prepared to say. any questions or comments on what I said here today, or about this article? I kept referring to the author or something like that, but I should have gotten the name out here. I have it here. Oh, here we are. Galadriel Watson was her name. And it's called Awestruck, and it's in the June 2020 issue of Discover magazine, which is kind of a light science magazine. But any questions or comments or observations or experiences of awe? Whatever. So again, awe, you know, it's, I'm not putting down or, you know, in any way like that, or if I contrast it with awakening, yeah, but that doesn't diminish awe. Awe is quite wonderful, and I would say necessary in order to fully awaken. It's just like the mountains are mountains, and then the mountains are not mountains. That's kind of the awe stage. It's necessary, but it's not enlightenment itself. So I hope I made that clear. Yeah, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks for your talk, Steve. I just thought a couple moments of awe, I guess, in my life. One is being in the Boundary Waters for the first time and hearing the loons at night when you're calling across. That always it never gets old. And when I was younger, my family went out west and we went to the Redwood Forests, and not only because my favorite movie is Return of the Jedi, which was partially filmed in the Redwood Forest, but just the trees themselves, just it was like you had transported yourself back in time to, like you said, just words can't describe, but yeah.
Yeah, I know both those places you described, the Redwood Forest and the Boundary Waters, and I agree totally. Yeah. Anyone else? Mike.
So from the standpoint of awakening, what this talk was about was, don't look for something awesome there. Don't look for something special.
Yeah, don't look for anything special.
Every day's in.
The special can only appear purely to the conceptual.
Conceptual.
Yeah. That's to ignore the perceptual, which is always there.
Right.
And the awakening is with that. And that's always going on. We already have this. We already know this awakening. But we miss it because we're so caught up with the conceptual. The conceptual is necessary, you know, but we lose ourselves in it. And we don't realize that this thing that might otherwise, to the extent that we will conceptualize it, seems awesome to us. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, in its pure experience of it, I wouldn't call it awesome. Mm-hmm. So don't look for anything like that.
Yeah. Going forward is a matter of everydayness.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
David.
Thanks. What about the vast emptiness that Bodhidharma told Emperor Wu about?
Yeah, vast emptiness and nothing holy. Sometimes it's also just simply vastness and nothing holy. But it's the same sort of thing here. With this vastness, that is the experience here. In some sense, it seems vast, but to the extent that we'll turn it into something vast, it's now just the ordinary. And even though, look at how huge this is. Yeah, okay, I understand, but it's still just thingness. It is just that. And so that's why Bodhidharma said nothing holy, nothing grandiose. Of course, the word holy actually comes from the word whole, you know, W-H-O-L, at least I believe. I think it's associated with it. That's what it is, but it is certainly nothing special because we're never apart from it. It's always just right here. So nothing special about it, nothing holy about it. Vastness, perhaps, is just all-encompassing or something of this sort. But of course, what we're doing here too, we're using words, and words really can't, you know, capture this. So I don't know what else that I can say about it in regards to what we're talking about here now. I just wouldn't get too taken by the word itself. And that particular koan is translated in various ways. I mean, it's expressed in a number of ways. Vastness and nothing holy, or vast emptiness and nothing holy, and other expressions as well, which don't come to mind at the moment. But I just wouldn't hang on to those too much. All Bodhidharma was expressing there was, because the emperor had asked them, I've done all these wonderful things, and Bodhidharma didn't seem to be too impressed with that, and so the emperor then asked him finally, well, what is the meaning of the holy truths? And Bodhidharma just said, vastness and nothing holy. You know, so it's vastness could be something holy, something special. It's all enveloping. Here it is, but nothing special about it. I believe that's what Bodhidharma was aiming at there with Emperor Wu.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, David. Anything else? Okay, well, if that's it, it was good to see you all this evening. I hope you have a good night now, and if you experience anything vast and wonderful, that's great. Just don't confuse it with enlightenment. Okay, goodbye now.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.